What I get to talk about today is one of my favorite things to ever talk about, and I could talk about it every week. So that is why he's worthy. And quick word over the word, and then we'll get into the word. Heavenly Father, just I pray you'd speak, and I'd just stay out of your way. And I pray that you'd help people to listen and drink it deep, and just, Lord, touch hearts like never before, maybe some hearts for the first time through your power, for your glory, through your spirit in Christ's name. Amen. I have one single goal. I'm not going to beat around the bush on this today. To show you why Jesus Christ is the only person on this planet, only person in the known universe who's worthy of your worship and your allegiance, period. And don't apologize for that. And I respect other people's beliefs. But I think if anyone could see, one, the evidence, and two, the love, it would be no question who's worthy to be praised. And took me a long time to make that decision because I was skeptical. And I know that I know that I know Jesus Christ is real and that he's worthy. We're going to talk about today. Not because of his great power or his magnificent creation. That's all awesome. But because of his character and his heart. And being God, his humility, that he served us and loved us and did everything he could possibly do for us first. And he doesn't ask you to bow down and worship him like a worm. He says, I'm giving you everything because I love you. Will you love me back the same way? That is a God worth worshiping. The only one. And I want to give a note to new Christians, and I don't have time to go into all this. It's for another Sunday. But buddy, I challenge you to do it on your own. Everything I'm going to tell you about today and everything we're going to discuss to the open mind and to the scholars, whether they're secular or Christian, has been established in ancient history as surely as any event you could talk about. And I won't go into all that evidence today, okay? But what I'm going to do, for those of you that are skeptical about the events that I'm getting ready to talk to you about, buddy, the proof is there in ancient history. But I'm going to give you two of the leading names in study of ancient history in the scholarly world, and tell you what they think about the events I'm getting ready to discuss with you. One is Professor Thomas Arnold. Some of you know him because in college you studied his work, a three-volume History of Rome. He's one of the most respected names of ancient history. This is his comment on the historical authority of the story we're going to talk about. Okay? Thousands and tens of thousands of persons have gone through it piece by piece, as carefully as every judge summoning up on a most important cause. I myself have done it many times, not to persuade others, but to satisfy myself. I have been used for many years to study the histories of other times and to examine and weigh the evidence of those who have written about them. And I know of no one fact in history of mankind which is proved by better and fuller evidence of every sort to the understanding of a fair inquirer than the great sign which God has given us that Christ died and rose again from the dead. And that's a historian. And that's for dramatic effect. So, and let me give you one more. Dr. Simon Greenlee, for those of you that know, this is professor at law at Harvard University. And he's responsible, mainly responsible for the rise of Harvard to its position today. This is what he says about the legal authority. It's the last thing I'm going to say because we could go for 2 weeks on this. But listen to what he says. According to the laws of legal evidence used in the courts of law, there is more evidence. Listen close to this, people. There is more evidence for the historical fact of the resurrection of Jesus Christ than for just about any other event in history. This isn't a Joe Blow Baptist preacher. This is the Royal Professor of Harvard University. Okay? So if you study, this is what I challenge you. This is for another day. If you would just go and study with an open mind, the proof is there for the story I'm getting ready to tell you. It's unmistakable, okay? So enough said. That lays the groundwork. And we're going to roll into this because I got some awesome things I want to cover with you, and I want to get you out of here before 3, maybe 2:45. I'm kidding. So we're going to start in an unusual place. We're going to talk about Jesus Christ, and instead of talking about him here as a man, first I want to read you one thing out of Revelation to show you the man Jesus. I want you to see who he is first in eternity, who he was before he came here, who he was internally while he was here, and who he is now. Okay? Because you can't appreciate the humble man on earth until you know who he is and what he gave up to be that humble man. So this is a picture of him in heaven in all of his glory. All right? Revelation 19:11. Then I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. The one sitting on it is called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and makes war. He's not meandering little pushover. His eyes are like flames of fire, and on his head are many diadems. And he has a name written that no one knows but himself. He is clothed in a robe dipped in blood. And we don't know whether that's his blood or the blood of his enemies. And the name by which he is called is the Word of God. And the armies of heaven, arrayed in fine linen, white and pure, were following him on white horses. From his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he will tread the winepress of fury of the wrath of God Almighty. On his robe and on his thigh, he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Wow. He will come and he will rule the nations. No one will stand against him. He is unstoppable. That is the power of the Creator. That is Jesus Christ. I want you to understand that is the raging lion inside of the sweet little lamb that we're going to read to you about, and it will make you much more appreciate him. Okay? With that picture in mind, here's where we're going. Oh, it's such a sweet story. We're going to see him now on earth as a simple man by choice for us. Simple and poor and uneducated and a total social reject because they all thought he was a bastard that didn't even have a father. He didn't have a home. He didn't have a church. He didn't have money. He would glean from fields to eat half the time while preachers today have their own jets. Go figure. This was God, God of the universe, would glean from fields to eat and stay with a friend because he didn't have a home. That's the kind of humble God that he is. How many of the gods that are man-made have to have the pomp and the circumstance and the glory? And the real God, the one that created the universe, came down and lived without a home to relate to us and to show us what's important. And we're going to pick up with him on the end of his 3.5-year ministry in the last hours of his life, the last few hours before what we're celebrating today, Easter. And we're not only going to walk through the events, some of the events you've heard before, but we're going to take an intimate look at the Jesus that Scripture is very, very accurately and clearly portray that we miss because of all the cliches that we've learned to just read over, right? And so we're going to take a real good look at who Jesus is while we look at these events. And every Easter, I either have to cover the evidence for Christ or what he went through because I would do an injustice not to. And if you've heard it, you need to hear it again. And if you haven't heard it, boy, you buckle up and you watch and you see what this man is made of. And you see why he deserves your glory. Let's start with Jesus in the last few minutes of his freedom on earth as a human. Just after the famous Last Supper, there's his course when he went up to the Garden of Gethsemane. And he goes out to a favorite spot in the garden that he's gone to many times to pray to his Father because he knows he's literally in the last few hours of his free life before literally all hell breaks loose and it's over. And this, my friend, we had a vial of a simulation of God's blood this morning. If I was going to fill it with his blood, this would be the place. It would be the most precious blood of all the blood that he shed. This would be the most precious blood because he was so horror-stricken. This is where the greatest battle in Jesus' life was fought. He was stricken with anxiety because he didn't want to do this. God allowed himself to take on flesh. Get this. If you listen, say amen. He allowed himself on purpose to become a human with all of our frailties. One, so we would know he understands us. Two, so he would know how we feel. But three, how could he suffer for us and feel what we felt and feel the agony we felt for our sake unless he could literally become one that would be susceptible to it? So God, in his humility, became a man and then humbled himself to reach the embarrassing state of emotionally and physically pushing himself to the end, till he broke as a human. So that anytime we break and we scream, God, why? He says, I understand how you feel. Because he had to take it for you so he could be part of who you are. And he literally, there's this thing called hematosis. Very rare, but very well documented. When you're under extreme stress and your body is literally going into shock because of the blood pressure behind your stress, the capillaries under your skin will burst into your sweat glands and you sweat blood. That comes from an extreme amount of anxiety. Jesus, in the garden, praying to the Father, was so torn, not torn over the physical torture he was about to endure. He never says a word. He faces it like a trooper. You're going to see how incredibly this man faces that. But here's what he was torn over. He was torn over the fact that anything and everything that has been done shameful and horrible by us, that we would never want to face anybody or let them even find out, all the rejection and the aloneness that we should feel as our punishment, he had it put on him. He had to feel rejected by the Father and by every man on earth, and he had to die alone, feeling in his heart that he was rejected and lost forever the way we should feel. Hell, my friend, is not just what you go through physically. Hell is realizing you amount to no one ever again. You are unloved. You are thrown away. You are rejected. And the sweetest heart in the universe, Jesus Christ, allowed himself to feel that way and have separation from the Father and die alone. That separation is what he couldn't bear. And it tore him up so bad that he literally went into shock and began to sweat blood. He was pushed beyond his limits, beyond any limit you have ever faced. Has anyone in here ever broken down and sweat blood? And don't pray to him and say, you don't understand how I feel. How could you do this to me? Okay? Listen to the verse. Mark 14:32. And they went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, sit here while I pray. And he took with him Peter and James and John, and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. He knew he was already in the throes of shock, which can kill you. Remain here and watch. And he goes a little farther and fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Daddy, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me. Luke 22:42. Saying, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. In Luke 22:44, and being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and the sweat became great drops of blood falling to the ground. Now, I want you to imagine something for me for a minute. I have three boys. Imagine if one of your children came to you. They were outside praying. They were facing whatever they're facing in life. And they come in and they're shaking all over uncontrollably. Eyes are bloodshot, sweating, literally sweating blood. And they come to you in a panic and they say, Dad, I know you have the right. You can do anything you need to do. You can stop this. Whatever's getting ready to happen to me, you can stop it, Dad. Would you stop it? And then they go and they pray and they come back. And three times your kid in tears, sweating blood, shaking, literally you think they're going to drop over dead, says, Dad, please, you can do anything. Will you please do this? How would you feel? And that's how the Father had to suffer with the Son to see this. Now, here's the deal. What if your child came in the third time, literally covered in bloody sweat? You had to hold him to stop him from shaking and said, Dad, I trust you. If this is what I have to do for you, I'll do it. I love you. How would it make you feel? What would you think of that kid? Jesus Christ told the Father, literally, imagine God allowed himself to be humbled and humiliated enough to be falling apart in shock, sweat and blood, and say, if you can stop this, please stop it. I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. And then he says, nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Because he decided. And at that point, listen, Jesus Christ could have gotten up and said, foul ball, they ain't worth it, Lord. And he could have gone home. And you know what the Father would have said? Welcome home, son. He wouldn't have said a word because Jesus was innocent and he didn't have to do it. He just said, if there's any other way, let me do it. And when the Father answered with silence, like we sometimes hear, Jesus Christ said, I will do whatever it takes to bring them home. And in that garden, when he prayed, when he was about to die the most horrific death in the world to get glory, do you know what he said to the Father? He said, the glory that I win today, give to them. Give it to them. Let them be glorified in your eyes. That's the Jesus that we serve. The Jesus that would say, as God, I will come down and humiliate myself and be so racked with fear and anxiety as a human that I literally am about to die and I will do it for you because I love you. How can we possibly say that we can't serve a God like that? And to think that Jesus is God, he's the great warrior with unlimited power that we just read about. And he chooses to do this to take away our pain. Question, look at me. That's a true story. How much do you think that God loves you? Whether you feel like you deserve it or not is beside the point. He knows we don't deserve it. How much do you think he loves you? So that's the point that he surrenders to God's will. And he gets up from his knees on that garden and he never speaks another word of protest. He's resolute. He says, okay, I got my answer. This is the way we're going to do it. So be it. Bring it on. That's my Jesus. So after that, he goes from there, from the garden, to Annas, who was a previous high priest of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin with this religious and legal court system to the Jews. They were a farce. Just proud of themselves. He goes to Annas, who was a previous priest, and then Caiaphas, the current priest. And that's in the middle of the night, and it's a cheap, fake trial. And he goes from there, and they take him to Pontius Pilate, who's the governor of the Romans. He's the one with the real authority, to a real trial. Pontius, wanting to avoid the whole issue, sends him to Herod, who's a tetrarch. He's like a puppet king of the Jews. And everybody's trying to shift him to somebody else, right? And then Herod's like, no, I'm not going to deal with this. And he sends him back to Pilate. And here's why. Because the Romans want him killed. They hate him because he's revealed how much of a jerk they all are. I mean, not the Romans, but the Hebrews. But they can't condemn him to death. So they tell the Romans after shuffling all around, they say, this man is trying to be a king and overthrow the Roman government. By saying that to Pontius, the governor, he has to take action or else it would look like he was allowing someone to rise up against Rome. So now Pontius has his hands tied and he has to go ahead with the execution. And so, after that final trip to Pontius Pilate, it's established, Pontius realizes he's got to do something and he condemns Jesus Christ. But now through all of these trials, through the fake trials, and through the real trials, the God of the universe is in chains, standing in front of men. Remember that God that I told you about in all of his glory? Tens of thousands of angels singing his praise, ultimate power in his hands, going to rule the nations with a rod of iron. He stands there, shaking, in shock, in shackles and chains, blood dripping off his face already because he's sweating blood. And this is what happens through these mock trials. Matthew 26, 67. Then they spit in his face and struck him. And some slapped him, saying, prophesy to us, Christ. Who is it that struck you? Okay, I'm sitting here shaking from head to toe. I'm in shock. I'm sweating blood. I know I'm going to die. And you've got these big, tough soldiers in his face, clearing the phlegm from their throats and spitting in his eyes and punching him in the face and slapping him. The God of the universe. There is one reason why he took it. Because he loved them. And he loves you. He loved them even when they did it. That is why he is deserving of our love and our allegiance. Even then, instead of saying, do you know who you're spitting on? Do you know what you're dealing with? In his heart, it was, They don't know what they're doing. I love them. I love them. I'm here to save them from the sin that they're doing right now by spitting in my face. And you better doggone guarantee if you bring me up and you punch me in the face and spit, I'm going to fight back if I got anything in me. But the God of the universe decided no. And they didn't, listen, these are soldiers, some of the best of the best. Ben, what would happen if we got in front of some of the best Special Force soldiers around and you said, hey, have your way with them, have some fun? What would I look like when they were done?
Well, I know a case where a guy shot a man for calling
Green Berets. There you go. So, let me tell you, Isaiah was written hundreds of years before Jesus was born. And Isaiah describes a scene, and this is what he says, Isaiah 52:13. See, my servant will prosper. He will be highly exalted. But many were amazed when they saw him. His face was so disfigured, he seemed hardly human. And from his appearance, one would scarcely know he was a man. He didn't get clocked in the face a few times. He got beat to smithereens. The word in Isaiah says crushed, meaning beat down. Meaning, have you ever seen someone who got beat so bad when you see the news that you couldn't tell who they were? That was Jesus. He was beat and slapped and punched so badly that you couldn't recognize who he was anymore. What kind of God would do that? And then, next, the most vicious and torturous part of anything that could ever be done, the public execution of the Romans was called scourging, the beginning of crucifixion. And the scourge in the Gospels, the word used, if I can say it right, is flagello. And that's where we get the word flagellum or flagrum, which is the instrument, the scorpion is what they call it, that they use. How many of you have seen The Passion for Christ? It gives a taste. Okay, this is what I want you, I want to talk about this, and for younger people, I'm sorry, but I want you to understand. There's no one in here too young to understand what we're getting ready to talk about. I want you to understand. I want you to see what Jesus went through. I'm going to read this to you, and then I'm going to discuss it. There's a gentleman by the name of Joel Donahoe who's done the most research on this in modern times of what this instrument was like and what scourging was like, okay? And this is what he says about it, and then I'm going to talk about it a little bit. This is a quote. This instrument was used with the purpose of bringing the accused to the threshold of death. If you listen, say, booyah!
Booyah!
All right. In the first century, still quoting, a Roman scourge was referred to as the sting of the scorpion. And these, by the way, these pictures are real things that we found that are connected, and then they were sharp, 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 but they're hundreds of years, thousands of years old. They were actually tied into the braids, okay? Real things that we found. Okay, known as a scorpion, done with a particular scourging instrument known as a scorpion, which was embedded with nails, sharp scraps of bone from the forehead of a ram, heavy circles of bronze and lead, often the thongs ended with metal fish hooks that were spurs that would catch the skin and pull off large strips of flesh, muscle, and fragments of bone. Most of the time, the bare ribs of the bone and the spine would show. Now, I got lots of quotes on this, but I'm going to give you two quotes from someone who lived during the time of crucifixions and saw them. And this is what they said about scourging and its effect. Okay? Listen. Eusebius of Caesarea. Their bodies were frightfully lacerated. Christian martyrs and Smyrna were so torn by the scourges that their veins were laid bare. The inner muscles, sinews, and even the entrails were exposed. For they saw that the bystanders were struck with amazement when they saw them lacerated with scourges, even to the innermost veins and arteries, so that the hidden inward parts of the body, both their bowels and their members, were exposed to view. Let me explain how this works. The extra weight on each strip was there. You get hit with a strip, then it's the strip, it's the weight of the leather, and that's it. You put extra weighted thongs on it, and the entire weight came across, and that weight would hit the skin so hard, just the weight, that it would hit the skin and burst it open. So you weren't being cut, you were literally being ripped open. And then they would put the spurs and the bones and the glass and all of these fragments in it, so that when you would get hit, not only would the skin get burst open, but the fragments and the hooks would attach to skin, muscle, bone, and you would hit and jerk away. It would split the skin open and dig in, And then you jerk away, and not only would it split the skin open, but it would tear strips away. And so the first few hits, you're literally quickly, the person is completely naked, okay? Passion of Christ did a favor for us just because it's TV. They stripped the God of the universe naked, tied him to a post, went all the way down his back and his buttocks and his legs. And first it tears the skin away. And then when there's no more skin, it's just in shards. And it's not the same as getting cut. It's burst and torn off. Then it hits the muscles and veins and the bones. And it's tearing out veins and muscle and bone. And literally, there are documented cases where people died because their inner organs fell out during this time. Almost always, you could see their veins and their bones through their skin by the time they were done. There could not be a worse way to die. If you did this and ended up not getting crucified, you wouldn't live anyway. Crucifixion was probably almost a mercy to this. And because of the blood loss, you would go into, let me see if I can say it right, hypovolemic shock, which means that you've lost so much blood that it's not supporting your organs and your brain and your body anymore. So he's already in shock. He's already weak. He's already shaking. Can you imagine going through this? All the skin on this man's body was hanging loose, and you could see his organs and his bones by the time they were done. This is God. Now, listen to what I'm getting ready to tell you next. Look at here. Okay? How many times have you thought, understandably so, God, why do you let such evil exist in the world? Okay, 2 points. One, this is how much he did to get rid of evil in the world. A little bit more than we've done. That's how much he hates evil. That's how much he would allow to be done to himself to save us from evil. Point two, he had to do this to take away the guilt and the effects of evil to make us whole again. But what if he just decided to get rid of evil? Well, where would he stop? Because last time I checked, guess what the origin of evil is? You and me. So if you say, well, God, why do you let this evil go on? Well, if he decided to take you up on that, guess how many of us would be left? Not a one of you sitting here, nor myself. And he couldn't bear to see us go away. He loved us too much. He couldn't get rid of us. So instead of getting rid of us, while we're in our cesspool of sin that we created, he came to take all of that so that it could be washed clean and we could start over if we so choose. But he wasn't just going to get rid of the evil because he would lose us. But how much more could he possibly have done to take away the evil and redeem us than what you're hearing here? That's how much he loves. That would any other king be worthy of being followed? After they beat him to this point that I'm sure he could, every second of his existence was screaming pain. Hypovolemic shock. Racked with unbearable pain, every inch of his body was a gaping wound that you could see all the way into his body with. Then, I want you to get this. He had already been beaten by some soldiers. Then, in that condition, imagine in that condition, knowing you're dying. People would just hopefully just stick you in a corner and leave you alone. No, instead of leaving you alone, this was the worst, most mocking time of his entire night. They put him, listen, in front of an entire Roman battalion. An entire battalion, and said, have fun. It was all part of the crucifixion. They would put him with the battalion and let them do anything they wanted to publicly humiliate and hurt him even more. So his face is disfigured, his body's torn to pieces, he's in shock. And then Romans 27 says, the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters and they gathered the whole battalion before him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, twisted together a crown of thorns, put it on his head, put a reed in his right hand, and kneeling before him, they mocked, saying, Hail, King of the Jews. And they spit on him, and they struck him in the head with the reed. The crown of thorns was not like briars that we see here. They were an inch and a half, 2 inches thick, much like you see up there. They shoved it down on his head. And I read doctor's journals. People that get scalp injuries, don't even go through the skull, but deep scalp injuries have died of loss of blood just because the scalp is so has so many veins in it. So they shoved this. He's already probably in the corner and on the floor. They put a robe around him. They shoved this crown down on him. And then an entire battalion commences to beating him in the head with sticks and driving the thorns into his head. And clearing their throat and spitting on him one more time. You're already dying. And then, I want you to get this one. Nothing left on his body that's not torn to pieces. Fragile, shaking, broken, spit in his face, a crown of thorns on his head. Then Pilate takes him in that condition and puts him out before the entire mass of people and puts him on parade to humiliate him even more. John 19:4. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I'm bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So Jesus came out. And that's a pretty good rendition of probably what he looked like. Wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to him, "Behold the man." Because what he had claimed to be, why were they killing him? He claimed to be God. And they brought him out here and said, "Here's your God. Behold the man." Oh, be glad I don't have the power of deity and was in that situation. Because we'd have a new human race on the planet Jupiter or something, because I would have mopped up. Jesus held his tongue. Can you imagine the pain that he was feeling at this point? The pain that he chose. You wonder why he's worthy. Now, I want to say something to you. All these people that laughed and mocked him standing there in front of Pilate, you listen. The battalion of men that bowed down in fake worship and then beat him in the head with sticks. Every one of them, one day, will bow again. For real. And they will know who they beat. Next, he carries the cross. And I don't believe, based on what I've studied, although it doesn't matter, that he carried the entire cross. He carried the patibulum. And then the other part, called the stipes, usually stayed in the ground, and they would carry the patibulum, which weighed 75 to 125 pounds alone. Imagine trying to carry that after what Jesus went through. So he had to carry that along the way. And the creator of the universe, somewhere along that trail, imagine putting that wood on shoulders that didn't have skin anymore. They were probably rubbing skeletal bone. The creator of the universe, somewhere on that 600-yard trail, allowed himself to be pushed to his last and fell. My God, allowed himself to become a human, and not only become a human, not only be punished, but allowed himself to physically, we already saw emotionally, pushed to the point that he sweat blood. I think he went farther than us. Allowed himself to physically push until there was nothing left, and he fell on his face with a 75 to 125 pound patibulum on his shoulders and could go no further. But it's hard for me to get up and come to Sunday school. How does that sound to him? I'm not trying to make you feel guilty. I want you to have a reality check. This is what the God of the universe allowed himself to be drained to. And I can't make it to church because I have to sleep in. But I love him like he loves me. And yet, he loves you still. Don't you ever say that Jesus Christ didn't give you everything he had. They had to get a man named Simon of Cyrene to carry the cross the remainder of the way because he was done. And then finally he was crucified. the most horrible, torturous, humiliating death ever devised. You were hung by your arms naked, and you died a slow, painful death of asphyxiation. And that cross beam was usually left up there, and even if it wasn't, even if he did carry the whole thing, they used the crosses over and over and over. So the cross you were getting ready to be nailed to, they didn't exactly carry them to a car wash. You were getting ready to be put up on a cross that was already covered in the feces and the urine and the blood and the bodily fluids of all the people that had died before you. And you were stripped naked, and your hands were nailed to the wood with 5 to 7 inch spikes, and they were driven through the wrist. And what happens is they were driven through in such, the Romans were so good at this, driven through in such a point that it would support your weight, but there's this nerve called the median nerve. Has anybody ever hit your funny bone? It's horrible. Imagine funny bone times 100. That's what the median nerve feels like. This spike was either driven through the median nerve or driven up against it so that it was in permanent pressure until they died. So that feeling you get when you feel the funny bone hit was times 100 through both arms the whole time he's on the cross. When I was going to get my blood drawn for what's to be the future, the nurse messed up and I almost dotted her eye in reflex. She stuck the needle in a nerve that goes through my arm and it still hasn't healed. I don't know if it will. And my son said it's happened to him. She stuck the needle dead into the nerve. And the pain that went through my hand was indescribable. That was a needle in one little nerve. This is a 7-inch spike driven through the biggest nerve going through your arm. So, the pain was there. And here's what happens. Let me show you the feet first, and then I'll describe the rest of it. The feet could have been and have been through both feet the way it shows there. But they have found other places, and the Bible's not clear. When you hear the three rusty nails, that's man's tradition. We don't know that it was three nails. The Bible never says three nails. So Jesus' feet could have been placed in front of him, just like it shows. But there are also, if you see that bone, that is actually a literal crucified victim that they found, the bone going, that the nail went through the ankle. The reason you don't find many of them is because the Romans used them over and over. But this nail got damaged and was left in the crucified victim. So your feet could have been in front of you on the cross, or sometimes they were put to the side like riding a bicycle, and there were two nails driven through the ankles and into the post. Either way, the way this is designed is once you get crucified, the entire thing is this. For every breath of air that you have to draw in, when you're hanging by the weight of the median nerves and the pain is shooting like crazy, you can breathe in. But it pulls the chest in such a way you cannot exhale. So then you have to push up on the nails in your feet, all your weight supported on those nails, and that allows the pressure to be taken off your chest and you can exhale and take another breath. So if you stay on the cross for 6 hours, that is thousands of repetitions of pushing all of my weight on nails going through the bones in my feet, exhaling, breathing in, and letting the weight come back down on my hands. Until I'm too weak and I'm hurting too bad. Every breath I take has to put myself in excruciating pain till I'm too weak and don't care and don't want to do it. And then I begin to partially asphyxiate and my body goes numb enough that I can push again. And it goes on and on like that. It's beautifully designed. And in the meantime, every time you push up, how much flesh does he have left on his body? And that's getting scraped up the wood. And in the meantime, he can't move. And they say that at those times, it was an insect feast. Insects are all over the body because they're attracted to things like that. And you're just being feasted on by insects, and there's nothing you can do about it. There have even been written accounts that birds have landed and began to work on their flesh while they're alive. And you can't do anything about it. So every breath is agony. I'm already, every joint in my body is screaming. I'm already in shock. I have insects on me. And I am completely naked, being glared at by my enemies and by my loved ones. And you're not way up in the air like you see in the movies. You're probably, your feet are probably 1.5 or 2 feet off the ground. You're right there with them, buddy. And when they did this, can you imagine what he's feeling like at this point? Now listen, they come to him in a little bit of mercy that they show, and they soaked a sponge and some really cheap, yucky-tasting vinegar wine to let him drink up to dull a little bit of the pain. Hey, get you a little buzz and take a little edge off. When Jesus tasted it, not knowing what it was and realized what it was, now this is where I told you he didn't fear anything physical. When he tasted and realized what it was that they were offering him and why, he turned it away. Did you get that? One little piece of the dampening of the effect he could have had, and he said no. My Jesus feared nothing physical. You know why he said no? He said, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing it for you. Everything I take on me is to pay for what you should have, and I will not miss one ounce of what my Father has allowed me to take for my brothers and sisters. He even turned away a swallow of alcohol to take the pain away because he wanted to feel everything. At that point, I would say, can you get a jug on the stick? Right? So he hung. He was in hypovolemic shock, so he was dying. He was having what they call exhaustion asphyxia. He was slowly dying because his lungs were filling with fluid. He was getting weaker and weaker. His blood was getting thicker and thicker because there was less and less of it, so he wasn't taking in enough oxygen anyway, and he wasn't breathing enough times because it hurt too bad. So he has hypovolemic shock. His organs are literally shutting down. He can't get enough breath. He's going into congestive heart failure because he's beginning to get fluid around his heart and lungs. And this is when he says, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Even then, all he cared about was the people around him. He didn't want them to be punished for what they were doing. And you better be glad he said that, because they were not the only ones that put him in that spot, were they? We were. Every time you've ever done something and you got nervous and shaky and worried and hoped nobody would find out before you did it, and you did it anyway, if nothing else had happened on the earth, that is wicked enough, and that's a bad enough seed in your heart to have made you miss heaven, and he wouldn't have stood for it, and he would have done that anyway. So when he said the words, Father, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing, guess who else he meant it for? Every one of us. In his last tormented breath, the God of the universe, who should have got a big old eraser and started over, thought about nothing but us. Guess what? That's my king. Is he yours? Finally, mercifully, he dies. And a legionnaire drove a spear through his chest. Does anybody know what came out? Blood and water. Okay. Very significant, and they didn't know what they were writing at the time they wrote this. Two things. One, it says that his final cause of death was probably, out of all those things he was dying of, his final cause of death, which is pretty cool when you think about it, was heart failure. Because that water that he collected around the heart shows that he was in cardiac arrest, cardiac failure. Two, the blood and the water that came out is a medical and historical, listen to me, medical and historical guarantee that he was dead before the spear ever hit him. Listen to this. This comes from the Journal of American Medical Association. Dr. William D. Edwards. Clearly, the weight of historical and medical evidence indicates that Jesus was dead before the wound to his side was inflicted, and supports the traditional view that the spear thrust between his right rib probably perforated not only the right lung, but also the pericardium and the heart, thereby ensured his death. And I listened to an article by a modern-day emergency room doctor who said if that wound had been suffered by Jesus and water and blood had come out and he was in the emergency room and we were here with him in modern technology, we couldn't have saved him. He'd have been gone in 2 minutes if he wasn't already dead. He goes on. Accordingly, interpretations based on the assumption that Jesus did not die on the cross appear to be at odds with modern medical knowledge. Let me tell you this. When Jesus Christ was executed, he had four executioners that looked like that. Four executioners had to verify that he was dead. Four. They did this every day. And guess what happened if they misdiagnosed and found out Jesus was still alive? Those four soldiers were crucified. And having seen what these people went through, how sure do you think they were that Jesus had to die? So think on this for a minute. All right, you ready? Think on this for a minute. Jesus was in extreme shock. His body was sweating blood. He was mercilessly beat until he was unrecognizable. Every inch of his body was scorched until his skin was laid open and his veins and his arteries and his bones and his organs were showing. Thorns were driven in his scalp. He hung on a cross that way for 6 hours as he suffocated, and then his lung and his heart were thrust through with a spear. Now, if any of you think you could possibly live through that, come on up and let's do an experiment. Love to let you try it out. And then in that condition, you were laid in a tomb untended for 3 days. I'll be all right. This, Jesus Christ is the most adored person in heaven. This is what this sweet, sweet, adored, most powerful, who could make you bow down and turn to ash, this is what he did because he loves you. In the book of Revelation, when John is having a vision, and they're talking about opening the scroll, who's worthy to open the scroll to bring the judgments on the earth? An angel says to John, look here at the lion. And so he's waiting for this magnificent lion to step forward. And he says, look at the lion. And guess what shows up? A lamb. He is the lion. He's worthy to be the lion because he first became the lamb. And the first time he came, everybody was looking for the lion, and he came as a lamb. And now we're all just snowed over, and we expect good old my buddy doll Jesus to show up. Now we're looking for a lamb. Guess what comes next time? A lion. He's done all he can do to save you, and he loves you. But if you choose not to love him back, there is no more lamb. The price has been paid. You accept it or you don't. And if you don't accept it, the lion comes next time. He chose to put himself in a position to be pushed beyond any limit we've ever known. And I said this at the Nativity, but I want you to get this for those of you that have never heard it. In our perfect bodies in heaven, Jesus Christ will have the only perfect body that is still ridden with scars. You picture a God that's humble enough to wear scars all over his body. I know he's got them because in his resurrected body, when he showed himself to his own disciples, what did he say? Put your hand here. Put your finger here. Touch my side here. He has the wounds to this day. My Jesus in heaven has a physical body because he wants to live with his brothers and sisters in the New Jerusalem. And that body holds the scars today. That's my Jesus. He was pushed beyond his limits so that you could be spared. He was completely rejected and died alone, hanging on a cross, feeling like no one would ever love him again, because that's how we would feel, and he had to pay for that so you would never have to. As bad as our existence might become in this world, if you're a Christian, you will never experience how bad it could be because he already did for you. He did it so he could spare you, and he did it so he could share in your experiences. And that's why my Jesus ought to become your Jesus. And I don't like cheap tricks and emotional times and big numbers. I could care less. What I would like to see is people that really, 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 really understand what he's done, and they make a lifelong commitment that their life is his. Not a happy little sweet prayer so I can put another notch in Word of Light's belt. Who gives a hoot? I want somebody that sees that this is real, and that man, that God, that King is worthy of everything you can give him, and you give your life for real. Who cares what you say anyway? His last words off the cross, we talked about this morning from John, tetelestai. Tetelestai means it is finished. Meaning all the work that Jesus Christ ever had to do to take us in our disgusting world that we have created, make us as pure as He ever was, and make sure that we can not only live in a place that we cannot fathom, but we can enjoy the love from a man like that. It is done. It is finished. He did it all. All you have to do is say, oh my gosh, I can't believe I was loved that much. If you will love me that much, I want to give my life back to you. And if you heard what this man went through for you, and it is a piece of history, and you realize it's true, and you refuse to give your heart and your service and your allegiance to that man, you care about no one but yourself. Because there is no one more worthy than my warrior king turned into a humiliated, loving, sacrificial lamb for his people. Did he do it in vain for you? Please consider that. You don't even become a Christian. You don't even give your heart to Christ to win your ticket to heaven. You do it because how can that man not be glorified and honored? I don't understand why every manly man in America and all over the world, every manly man that understands what it's like to be a man and stand up, cannot see that this warrior did everything deserving of the allegiance of the people under him. We should fall at our feet and give him everything we have as soldiers of Christ for a leader that would die that way for me. He's that precious. The only problem that I ever had with a story like this until I studied it enough to understand was it's too good to be true. It can't be real. And I have spent 30 years now studying it, and it's real and it's true. So this is all I ask you. And I don't care if you come down. I don't care if you talk to me. I just care about this. You don't leave. If it's true, how much do you have at stake? You either walk out of here saying, I want no part of this. Forgets you. Or you walk out of here saying, I can't live another day without serving this Jesus that did this for me. But don't you dare walk out of here undecided when that kind of action was taken to save your soul. You tell him get lost or you give him everything you got. But don't you walk out of here lukewarm. That's all I ask you. Turn your back on him. That's your choice. But don't walk out of here undecided when you see that kind of love. There's nothing that I just covered in here that's not historically provable. As we close in prayer, as we sing our songs, this is worthy of a response. I pray that you'd give yourself to that kind of love and you'd let your life maybe for the first time have some meaning and that we would all meet in Jerusalem one day. I always joke with Word of Light that we're going to go outside the city because it's always light in the city, but there'll always be day and night and seasons on the new earth. But we're going to go outside the New Jerusalem where it can get dark and we're going to look at the city from far away because there'll be people all over the planet. We're going to have a big old campfire once we get on the other side, and we're going to all talk about our stories when we were here. So we decided that's going to be our memory peg. The Word of Light crew is going to meet one day at a campfire right outside New Jerusalem. We're going to look at that beautiful city with Jesus' light shining through the crystal walls, and we're going to talk about these days of struggle, and we're going to laugh. My prayer is you could join us. Make a decision. Let's stand for prayer.